what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Good afternoon, all you Friday listeners. Glad to have you along with us this afternoon. Indeed, I am. I'm going to do my best to bring you a good program today, and I hope you'll join in with us today by giving us a call at 866-546-5254. We'd love to have you give us a call. And by the way, if any of you folks live in the Washington, D.C. area, you can call our Washington, D.C. Bureau, 202-370-6153. Or if you live in Phoenix, Arizona area, you can give us a call at the Phoenix Bureau at 623-444-5252. We'd love to have you join us on the program today, and we're going to take calls after a while. Friday, normally a light day, normally a day that we lighten up and, well, let you talk about what you want to talk about, but we'll see how it goes today anyway, and we do hope you'll join us on the program. I guess if you're listening right now, you already have joined us on the program. Isn't that not true? I'm having one of those days today. Did you ever go to bed at night and you just couldn't sleep? I went to bed late last night, very late last night, around 11th. Well, for me, I had to get up early this morning. Went to bed about 11:30 last night, and about 6 minutes after 2 it was. And those of you that know me really well know that I always talk in exact terms when it comes to time. It was 6 minutes after 2. I looked over at the clock and thought, it must be time to get up, and I saw that it was 6 minutes after 2, and I will lay here a little while and go back to sleep. Which it became quickly apparent that I would not be able to do that. And so I got up at 2:15 and got a bunch of work done here in the studio that I needed to get done. I feel better as a result of it. But I've been yawning all day long. It's one of those things. So if you hear me yawning during the program today, forgive me. It wouldn't be the first time, I guess. But I am glad to have you along with us today. A very newsworthy day, as all the days have been as of late. And you folks on Democratic Underground, we mentioned to you on our post on there today that we were going to talk about, and honestly, I didn't mean it this way, but I guess you could most and should take it this way. I mentioned we were going to talk about greed and Dick Cheney. And I meant that as two different subjects, but I don't think somebody mentioned already on there that when was it? Where's this at here? You could spend days on that topic and not scratch the surface. Heck, you could teach a college course on Cheney's avarice, and future historians probably will. That's from Dudley Do-Right on there, and he's exactly right. Probably not a more greedy man in the world than Dick Cheney. There may be. There's a lot of greedy people on Earth. Are you greedy? Are you? I wonder. Greedy is something I'm not very fond of, and I don't think most people are. But there are many greedy people in the world, and they're getting to be more and more and more of them all the time. And I want to talk a little bit about greed today, and a little later on in the program, I'm going to talk about Mr. Dick Cheney as well, and then we can combine the two, maybe. I think we've reached a point in time that was foreseeable to many of us. I started to notice maybe about 15 years ago, I'd say. Somewhere around that time, I began to notice what I call the spread, and it's called many different things, but I call it the spread, and it's taken place at an accelerated pace. It started about 15 years ago, and by the spread, I mean the spread between the incomes or the level of wealth between the so-called upper crust of our society and those who don't have as much. And sure, we've always had the rich and the poor, and we always will. But for the most of the time I was growing up, the gap between the two was filled, and that gap was filled with the largest segment of the population, which was the great middle class. back in the 1880s and the early 1900s, there were the Carnegies and the Mellons and the Rockefeller and their ilk. And then there were the folks who worked in the mills, the mines, the farms, and other low-paying work. There was no middle class. The super wealthy and the super poor and the poor. That's all there was. And, of course, there were always many more poor than very wealthy. That's just the way it was. And because of that situation, the nation didn't flourish the way that it might. And the economy of the U.S. really, you might say, just languished for many years in kind of a semi-dormant stage. I mean, yes, the nation was growing, and we were getting to be a wealthy nation, but the wealth was concentrated in the hands of a very few people. And, of course, as it always does, along with that wealth came power. And the rich had control of everything, and they saw to it that all the laws benefited them, and they made sure that they held on to every dime they could while the poor working stiff. You know, he had a tough time just making enough to put food on the table in many cases. That's how it was. People worked long, long, long hours and all. But things began to change, and the really big change came after the Second World War. The great middle class began to really emerge at that time, and it was really the greatest thing that ever happened to this country, in my opinion. Is the great middle class. Our economy, for the very first time, just exploded. And for the first time, our economy actually flourished without having to depend on a war to stimulate it. And the wealth began to spread. And the numbers of rich stayed about the same, although they grew slightly. But the percentage of the population that was poor began to shrink. And many of the poor began sort of an upward mobilization into this new middle class. The middle class wasn't rich. They still had to work hard for a living, but they could now afford to buy a house instead of having greedy landlords take advantage of them. They began to own things. They could afford a car, a house, maybe even a little boat, you know, for out at the lake, possibly send the kids to college. The things that before now only the rich could afford to have, the great middle class could now start to get their hands on. And this explosion of the middle class sent the economy absolutely skyrocketing. You know, more cars were produced, more houses were being built, more appliances, more everything. And, of course, along with more of everything produced came more and better jobs. And life was getting good in America. And it's too bad that the entire populace of this country, especially all you youngsters, didn't have a chance to ever experience those times. Life was good in the country. And I know a lot of you young ones don't like to hear that, but it was. I mean, it was a wonderful time. And it was getting good for a record number of people. America, at that time, was the best it's ever been. The late 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and even the 70s. And then along came the 80s, and things began to regress. The Reagan years, the spread began to get larger and larger. The middle class began to thin out and drift away. And the troubling part of it all is that the middle class wasn't heading upward. It was heading down. And to be sure, a few of the middle class traveled the other direction into the rich class. But for the most part, it was a downward spiral for the middle class. And so just to keep up, most households now have to have two incomes, maybe even two full-time jobs and a part-time one, just to keep the bills paid. And sure, those folks could still afford a few luxuries, and they bought them, and they helped the economy keep going. They could still afford a small boat or a backyard swimming pool and a TV for the bedroom, but things were getting tighter and tighter. And we went through the 80s with the great middle class ever shrinking. Through the 90s, the trend continued, and these past few years have, well, things have deteriorated very, very rapidly. The jobs the middle class had to make their lives better were disappearing at a very rapid rate. The automotive jobs in Detroit, the union jobs in the trades, the factory jobs in many industries that paid good money were pulling up stakes and moving to Mexico and China and elsewhere. Anywhere the owners could get labor for 10 cents on the dollar. It was called progress. I call it something else. I call it greed. Pure, old-fashioned, unadulterated, American-style greed. The bottom line is that the mega corporations started moving the jobs elsewhere to make their bottom line look better. Their stockholders wanted more money. The managers wanted bigger bucks. The Walmarts and the General Motors of the world needed to make more money, cheaper goods, more profit. It's that simple. And I've oversimplified it a bit, but that's the gist of it. Greed. And I can think of no greater example. And when you stop, you know, you think about that word, put it into personal perspective. Great examples of greed. Kenny Boylay and Skillings. We've both heard, you know, we heard about both of them very recently. Their greed with Enron really knew no bounds, and thousands of people who work for that company are suffering mightily because of those two greedy bastards. People who thought they had a pension don't have it anymore. And, you know, they deserve whatever they get in prison, plus a whole lot more. And I know a lot of you probably heard it as well, but I heard poor little Kenny Lay on TV the other night saying that he had to sell his vacation home and some other assets so he could afford to pay his lawyer. Guess what, Kenny? If you hadn't been so unbelievably greedy, you wouldn't have needed a lawyer like this now, would you? And how about Jack Abramoff, Tom DeLay, the just retired CEO of ExxonMobil? We could sit down and write quite a list of ultra-greedy people, the Walton family, the Chimkin family, the Koch family, and really dozens of others who are spending millions upon millions of dollars. Are you aware of this? They're spending millions of dollars to defeat the estate tax that they like to call the death tax. These wealthy families. Only trouble is, it shouldn't be called the death tax. And it never was. It was always called the estate tax. That's just a Republican trick to change it over and call it the death tax. So, because in no way does everyone who dies estate have to pay any tax. It really, in fact, affects only a very, very tiny percentage. About a half a percent actually pay anything at all. And even that's after, a $4 million exemption per couple. They're wanting to up that exemption. Greed is what makes the world go around right now. Not far from where I live, and perhaps a lot of you live, you can see people walking around with, lots of the Rolex watches. Just the other day, I saw a gentleman reach across the counter. He had a Patek Philippe watch on. I know it's $100,000. Palm Springs, Bel Air, Naples, Florida, the Bentleys, the Rolls Royces, $325,000 car. What's that? That Maybach, that Mercedes Chrysler contraption that came up that Limbaugh drives, $350,000, $250,000 Ferraris, on up. You see all that all over the place here in a lot of different places, certainly not in my driveway. In New York, they had an auction last May. A single magnum of Dom Perignon champagne sold for almost $6,000. And, of course, there's the painting. One evening not too long ago, two Monets sold for $43 million. And since then, even higher prices. Hotel rooms you can get for $10,000 a night just a couple miles up the road at the Ritz-Carlton and other fabulous hotels around the world. You know, estates, the suburbs of Dallas and Palm Beach and right down the road here in Naples, Florida, they've got houses for sale for $20, $30, $40 million. Those are the prices paid by the exceptionally wealthy, the folks who skim the pages of the Robb Report. I like that magazine myself. It's a nice dream book. The average salary of subscribers to the Robb Report, by the way, I found out is $1.2 million. But, you know, in that book, that doesn't include me, by the way, but in that book, whose, you know, really glossy pages are reviewed, the very best of everything, I was looking through a recent edition of it, and they had a southern plantation advertised. Everybody's dream, it said, $8.5 million, and, you know, that's one of the cheap ones. Robert Reich pointed out that the super rich live in a kind of a parallel universe to the rest of the country, and I couldn't agree more. And most of the time, you don't see these people. We have these charity auctions around here a couple of times a year, and the movie stars from Hollywood come in, and they pay, you know, outrageous prices for things. These are people you don't know, that you don't see. They live behind walled estate walls. They travel in private limos, and they use different airports than the rest of us do. And there's a lot of them. There's now over 200 billionaires. 5% of American households have assets over $1 million. And when you take a look at the figures, we're back to levels of extravagant consumption not seen for over 100 years. This really is, it has become a nation of persistent and resilient people with an unshakable mission, and that mission has always been the pursuit of happiness. And this idea of happiness is really, in most people's mind, connected with wealth. It's become a nation of ambitious people with notions of dreams of unfettered future growth. A nation that celebrates abundance. And there's nothing wrong with that. And there seems to be no reason anyone should be deprived of luxury if he works hard. With this country's aggregate wealth, and you should think about the wealth there is in this country, there should be no reason anyone should ever go hungry or suffer in this country. But people are going hungry in America. A recent Los Angeles survey found more than a quarter of low-income residents in that area, many working, are not getting enough food to meet the basic nutritional needs, and 10% are experiencing hunger. And there are estimates that I've sought out recently that say that 3 out of 10 Americans will face poverty sometime in their lives. Misery is a word seldom applied to the contemporary scene, like wretchedness. It seems antique, kind of an old world term, but many Americans do live in cold, dank slums. And a lot of them don't earn enough for shelter. A lot of people live outside. And you can see it in America's inner cities and at its lowest levels under the freeway bridges and the alleys and the stained and broken rooming houses and in torn apart schools. Misery does exist. And it persists. All of our largest cities contain neighborhoods where some people live day to day in apartments that could be mistaken for closets. A lot of them afraid to leave home because they live on gang-terrorized streets. A lot of people you see on the, afraid to even get on the bus because there's people on there that got drug-scarred arms. Every great metropolis has a skid row where whole blocks are awash in narcotics and violence, and its inhabitants despised and flatly abandoned. Now, America is a nation of extremes. And really, as the society grows in here, in the country, it becomes more unequal. The aggregate wealth goes up. Equality goes down. Just in the last decade, population's going up by 13% in this country, 281 million people, and the wealth has been concentrated in fewer hands. Always fewer hands. The money is going up and up and up. It trickles up, not trickled down. America's earnings are more unequal today than they have been any time in the past 60 years. Some corporation CEOs have been making over 400 times the hourly rate of their lowest worker. Imagine that. Imagine being the CEO of a company and having the nerve to walk out on the floor of that assembly plant someplace, whatever they happen to be doing, and knowing that you're making 400 times more than the guy that's out there working, putting in his hard 40 every week. And this inequality is not just a feature of business. It spans a variety of professions. Musicians, your favorite athletes. Take Alex Rodriguez, $252 million for a 10-year baseball contract. $170,000 a game. $170,000 for every baseball game. That's about $45,000 every time he just comes up to bat. Imagine that. And there's people receiving average allocation of $83 a month in food stamps. When you really stop and look at it, the inequality here in this country is astronomical, and the chances of closing it so small that it doesn't feel like a real freedom anymore. If the best off are sealing themselves off, the worst off are also doubly fenced off, and this time by the distrust and the aversion from those on the higher level. this society is, I think we're suffering. We're suffering from a lot of things. And it's flamboyantly optimistic and self-congratulatory, this society is. And the puzzle is, why does this society allow the suffering? The inequalities are stunning. But so many times when you discuss this issue, the frequent attitude is people, you know, shrug their shoulders and say, so what? A lot of times this day, it's hard to get a rise out of a person when talking about this subject. I like to ask the old psych question that so many of you have studied over the years, and I did as well. Suppose there are people living on one side of a big city who throw weekly parties so lavish that afterwards they're throwing out meat, while on the other side of the same time, the same town, there are people so poor they can't afford to buy meat. Is this a moral problem? You know, you get a spectrum of answers. No problem, some people say. Yes, of course, so other people say. And in between, some people say, well, it's a technological but not an ethical problem. And some people say, maybe, but what are you pushing here? You know, you get some yawns. As if the question were so old-fashioned. I believe the variety of these responses eventually leads to a question of what kind of society we live in. And I'll tell you what I think, what kind of a society we do live in. We live in a winner-take-all society. And there's a lot of people that look at that and go, yeah, right. It is a winner-take-all society. It's dog-eat-dog, winner-take-all. You know, my first point about that is that these extremes of wealth are connected. While the rich are growing richer, the poor are growing poorer, and this is no coincidence. Defenders, of course, argue that the rich getting richer benefits everyone, and that you know, they can all rise together. You know, the old trickle-down theory. In fact, these are not arguments, but meaningless cliches. Competition is a process which really results in inequalities, winners and losers. And it cannot be in a society of free competitive units. The competition among all is good for all. The fact is that our economy has become so tilted toward big business that we're becoming a winner-take-all society. And the problem with that is there are so few winners but millions of losers. And we've become more unequal. The United States is still the wealthiest nation on earth, but its 20% child poverty rate ranks worse than all of the European nations. Did you know that? I recently read a survey that shows the gap between the wealthiest and the poorest in America is now greater than any time since Imperial Rome. And I just want to end this little rant up by telling you that, of course, as you know, you can tell by hearing me talk that I'm not an expert economist. I don't have all the answers, but I do know enough to realize that we're charting a very, very dangerous course here. I forget who said it, but this long time ago, somebody said you can have democracy or you can have all the wealth in the hands of a few, but you cannot have both. And I'm afraid that's exactly where this nation is headed right now. It's a desperate situation that's got to be taken care of. And nothing is being done about it. Do you have an opinion? 866-546-5254. I'd like to hear from you. Let's see. What do we have scheduled to do right now? Okay. I guess we're going to take a quick break right now. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Thank you.
this war, we got another failed attempt. As if it makes them money, they might just give you life this time.
When Bruce and I filled in for Bob Kincaid, we didn't know what to expect, but we sure didn't expect a call from the decider.
I told Walmart to sell the Easter egg die kits, you know, the ones with the resurrection egg. We decided at Camp David that we were going to support Walmart and go with what the Lord told them and buy some of them resurrection egg kits. And, you know, I found the resurrection egg. God spoke to me through that egg. And God told me that I am the fourth member of the Holy Trinity. We're calling it the Holy Quadraphonic. And so now I'm the fourth voice of the Holy Trinity. So now I've got four voices in my head. I have the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost and the Decider. I'm the Decider. I get to decide.
Don't miss Head On with Bob Kincaid weekdays 7 to 10 p.m. and Fourth Estate Radio with John Fox and Bruce Birch Saturdays 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the Head On Radio Network.
And we're back. Well, 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 here we are halfway through the first hour of the program. It's one of those days. I'm having one of those days. You ever have one? Just kind of the whole day's been helter-skelter. No plan to this day today. Just didn't, one of those days it just didn't work out. And, a lot of things in the news. I thought maybe some of you might want to talk about the Robert F. Kennedy Jr. article in Rolling Stone. Puts forth an extremely convincing argument that the 2004 election was in fact stolen in Ohio. Him and Brad Friedman and all, there's little doubt about this, that what happened. I mean, it's backed up with more facts than any of the newspapers even want to fool with. And yet the mainstream media just stay away from the story like it's got the plague. They just don't want to talk about it. I would venture to say that if this story ever did hit like 60 Minutes or one of those programs, America would quickly change their minds about what happened in Ohio in 2004 and probably in Florida in 2000. The facts are there. All the media had to do was dig for them, and most of them were too lazy to even bother or too much owned by the right-wing fat cats to want to bother. That's one of the big problems. Did you see, now it appears that we've got another problem in Iraq. The BBC's uncovered new video evidence that the U.S. forces may have been responsible for the deliberate killing of 11 more innocent Iraqi civilians. Man, I'll tell you, I hope they get a handle on this soon. It's such an awful shame. And the problem is, they can't even get a handle on Iraq. The whole place, despite what Mr. Bush is, you know, the story that he's trying to sell. And is anybody listening anymore? And that would be a good question to ask your right-wing friends. Do you believe anything Mr. Bush says anymore? Have you learned by now that you cannot now, nor could you ever believe anything he said? Have you learned that? If you haven't learned anything else? I'll tell you, I've got a lot of good Republican friends, and I was just talking to a good friend of mine this morning who's a Democrat, and we were talking about the political situation. And not long ago, I had a chance to sit down and talk to a good Republican. He's chairman of a local Republican county. Or he's the chairman of the Republican Party in an entire county, and he's a former legislator himself, and I did so enjoy getting a chance to debate him, and then we had a chance to have a long talk afterwards. And it's so refreshing to talk to an actual Republican, not one of these neocon freaks that's running the country today. And truth be told, and this gentleman is as much of a Republican as I think anybody could ever be, he's ashamed of these people. And he'd come right out and say it. Oh, he can't go. He can't go to the RNC and tell them that if he wants to keep his chairmanship and all that sort of thing. They kind of frown on that, and we have the same problem in the DNC. But he's ashamed. He's actually ashamed of this Bush administration, and says, you know, they're not Republicans. Don't link them to us. They're not Republicans. And then I asked the all-important question, did you vote for him? Well, yes. But I had to. Well, you didn't have to. And the part that just flat amazes me is, especially in 2004... I've said before, I'll give them a chance on that one. They were tired of the shenanigans of Bill Clinton and all, and they just wanted to wash their hands of the whole deal, and they didn't even give Al Gore a decent second look or a chance, and just went ahead and threw Bush into office. Okay, I'll give you that one. I don't like to, but I'll give it to you. And I don't really think he won that election. But anyway, he ended up in the office. But when 2004 rolled around and you did it again, that's the one that really got me. I thought for sure the real Republicans would stay away from the polls in droves. And I guess it just took a little more education. It took a little more time and a little more education, and people are finally figuring it out. If Bush had to run for office right now, they're probably, what, 24 people in this country that could beat him easily in an election? Easily. I mean, it wouldn't be any... He wouldn't be able to even raise any money, I don't think. He's in a tough position. And, you know, out bragging about Iraq again last week. Bragging about it. And once again saying about all the good news that the press is failing to report. These people just keep going on and on and on with this story, and it fascinates me. And did you see the New York Times yesterday? The story in it about the new prime minister there, Maliki. He's having trouble getting control of Basra now. Basra, the most in the Kurdish area, and Basra, the two most well-behaved, well-controlled areas in Iraq. And now Basra, the all-important port of Basra, is exploding with violence. They had this place so well under control, the British did. And now it's just literally going crazy in Basra, of all places. This is a place that hasn't even been mentioned in the news for months and months and months, a couple of years, actually. Because it was very peaceful. And there had been 174 killings in the last 2 months. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And, you know, Maliki comes down there and he orders the Iraqi army to take over Basra's streets, which kind of surprised the British army, which patrols the region. And, you know, they're going to have to bring in Iraqi units. Maliki's talking tough. He said, I declare strongly and frankly that we will strike with an iron fist on all the gangs that are manipulating security. Well, it's a little bit more than manipulation, Mr. Maliki. Quite a bit more than that. I mean, just in May, 9 British soldiers were killed, and you're starting to hear rumblings from the British folks now. They haven't had that many people killed over there. But they had 9 killed, the second deadliest month for the British since the invasion. Exceeded only in January of 2005 when the crash of a British military plane killed 10 soldiers. So actual battle deaths. But Maliki's trying to figure out what's going on there, and he cannot. And you ask American officials. They say, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, it just hasn't quite worked out the way it was planned. They're not prepared to debate. They tend to do everything at the end of a gun. I mean, this was a city that welcomed the American invasion. And now there are threats against Iraqis working for the American embassy that are so widespread that they haven't even picked up the trash or pumped its sewers for 3 weeks. It's deteriorating. The entire country is deteriorating in a bad way, a very fast way. And yet, the Bush administration goes right on with their story stay the course. We're going to stay the course no matter what. And they are. I'll give them that. They haven't done anything differently. They're not about to do anything differently. Donald Rumsfeld still sits at the head of the Defense Department. No matter what goes wrong there, I guess he's going to stay no matter what. That's becoming more and more apparent. I thought, without question, that Bush would get rid of him a year or so ago. But I think now the question is, will Bush go before Rumsfeld? I think Rummy's there to stay. I could be wrong. But Bush, with his loyalty and all, and you have to face it. If he gets rid of Rumsfeld, he would be admitting a colossal mistake. Not only just the colossal mistake of having Rumsfeld as defense secretary, which is bad enough in and of itself. The other big problem is he would be admitting that the war was wrong. And he's just not going to do it. That they started out the war ill-prepared, ill-equipped, with a strategy that just wasn't adequate to do the job at all. And so by admitting that Rumsfeld was a failure, he would have to admit that he himself and his entire administration that worked on this war were also failures. And he's not going to do that, not anytime soon. I don't think. Do you? 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. Hope to hear from you. Going to take a short break. Be back in just a couple of minutes.
Peter said to Paul, you know all those words we wrote, just the rules of the game, and the rules are the first to go. But now talking to God is Laurel begging Hardy for a gun. I got a girl in the war, man, I wonder what it is we've done. Paul said to Petey, you gotta rock yourself a little. Pretend the dove from above is a dragon and your feet are on fire. I got a girl in the war, Paul, the only thing I know to do is turn up the music and pray that she makes it through. Because the keys to the kingdom got locked inside the kingdom. Fly around in there, but we can't see them. I got a girl in the war, Paul, I know that they can hear me yell. If they can't find a way to help, or they can go to hell. If they can't find a way. Yourself a little harder. Pretend the dove from above is a dragon and your feet are on fire. But I got a girl in the war, Paul, her eyes are like champagne. They sparkle, bubble over in the morning, all you got is rain. Sparkle, bubble over, and in the morning all you got is rain. The
sparkle bubble over, and in the morning all you got is rain.
Impressive crowd, the haves and the have mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
Oh, it's true.
Call Guy James now, 1-866-546-5254.
All right, we are back. Yes, we are indeed. And you know what? I was looking through the email during the break there. Had a few things to catch up on. And where is this here? I'm looking for this. Doggone it. I have so many emails. Back. Oh, yeah, okay. So, okay, I listened to your greed monologue. How about the one on the ambitious versus the lazy? Do you think there's any comparison? I would say that I wasn't talking during that whole thing about the ambitious and the lazy. There will always be lazy people in this country and every country on earth, and screw them. That's just the way I feel. I don't owe them anything. You don't owe them anything. If they're lazy, tough. As for being ambitious, when the jobs start to disappear, what about the guy who's had the job at the Whirlpools or the Timken Companies or the General Motors or the Delphi's? What about the people that had those jobs all of their lives and lost them all of a sudden? Are they going to go back to college and end up making the $20 an hour they were going to? No. The answer is no. They're going to be flipping burgers at McDonald's because those jobs are gone. And they can go train till hell won't have it. And they won't end up with jobs with that kind of money once again. They're going to take a kick in the ass is what they're going to take. And they won't be able to send their kids to college anymore. And the field's getting more and more and more tilted all the time. And guess who is getting tilted in favor of? The middle class is losing out. These were not lazy people, the middle class. They were the people that built this country. The friggin' Carnegies and the Mellons and the Rockefellers and the Timkins and those. They didn't build this country. The people that worked for them did. They weren't lazy people. They were ambitious, hardworking people that went to work every day, formed labor unions, went to work. Did their jobs. We're not talking about lazy people. We're talking about the opportunities for hardworking Americans disappearing, and they're disappearing because the wealth is shifting upwards. That's the crux of the matter. You know, Ronald Reagan's trickle-down economic theory is pure horseshit, and I think we've proven that by now. Everybody's proven that. There isn't anybody that believes that anymore, I don't think. I doubt there is. What happens when the great middle class can't afford to send their kids to college anymore? What happens? America gets stupid, that's what happens, and we lose out on the world stage. We're already behind in the sciences and in math and so many things in the world stage. We're importing engineers, for God's sake. When the middle class disappears from this country because their opportunities are gone, their employment opportunities are gone, this country will disappear. It's that simple. That's not melodramatic. That's not overly simplified. It is a fact that when the middle class from this country is gone, this country will no longer be what you and I know it to be. I don't sit here and complain about people that are lazy. I don't care about them. Hell with them. If they're lazy, screw them. I've got no use for people like that. Never did, never will. You'll never hear me complain on this program that some poor lazy guy didn't get a break. I don't care. That's a sin. Sloth is a sin. We've all got a little bit of it in us, maybe. I know I do. But people are different. People are not all born the same. Their minds don't all work the same. Their ambitions are not all the same. But I just want to make it clear, we're not talking about the lazy versus the ambitious. God bless the ambitious people. I'm happy for them. And screw the lazy. I'm not happy for them. It's the people in between that I'm worried about. The hard-working guy that gives the honest day's work that doesn't even have a chance to do that anymore. That's the guy I worry about. Hi, you're on the show.
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, hi, guys. This is Greg from Connecticut.
Hi, Greg.
I just wanted to comment, too, about this greed thing and the response to that email you just got a few minutes ago. You know, I think that that's generally sort of the way Republicans look at the world. You know, it's sort of this, oh, let's pull everybody up by their bootstraps type thing, and, you know, everybody's out on their own and this and that. But
just like Bush did. Pull themselves up with their bootstraps just like he did.
Yeah, this is an example I like to give people, okay? So first ask them, okay, do you think that Bill Gates achieved the American dream? And that's not a trick question. You know, I have a couple issues with Mr. Gates, but in general, yes. He brought up a company from nothing and built it up to be a multi-billion dollar company, okay? But then ask, well, what about, say, a bank robber? Now, they're smart enough to go in and beat the system and go and break into the bank and take all your money. Now, is that the American dream? And then they'll immediately say, well, no, because that's breaking the rules. And that's the whole point, that we as a society have to have rules, but if you work hard, and if you're honest, and if you don't hurt other people, then you can succeed. And that's where the basic issue is.
I agree. I agree. I agree.
We live in a society now where, you know, half the country is just a couple paychecks away from being on the street if they lose a job. Or we have millions of Americans who are in a position, if they lose their job and lose their health care, they can't deal with the medical crisis that comes up with their family. You know, and these are the type of situations that we're talking about. We're not talking about people who are lazy or that goddamn bankruptcy bill. You know, people again and again say, oh, yeah, it's for those lazy people who go out and buy a speedboat. No, it's about the mother who can't afford to get her kids medical care because she doesn't have a job anymore.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you hear it all the time. And you ask, what about the guy with 20 years in the union at General Motors? He loses his job. The plant's closed down. Well, so he can go back to school. He can go to adult education. I did it, and he can do it. And, you know, he's 57 years old, and he goes in and applies for a job, and they look down their nose at him because he's 57 years old, for one thing, and the only thing he's done is work for General Motors on the assembly line for the last 20 years.
And not just that, but, you know, Republicans love to talk about pulling yourself up from your bootstraps.
Yeah.
But, you know, they do everything they possibly can to keep someone from pulling themselves up from bootstraps. If you're a poor mother or whatever and are not educated, you know, they don't want to fund education, they don't want to make it easy for someone to go and improve themselves. They don't want to do anything about child care because that's socialism, to have affordable health care. You know, it seems like anything you try and do, if you're in a lower class position, something like that, to try and better yourself, the Republicans aren't interested in doing that either.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, I couldn't say it any better. You're right on the money. You are.
You know, and then time, you know, when it comes to all these things that the Republicans don't like, you know, oh, you know, we want a smaller government and this and that and the other, you know, but then it comes down to, well, what about the money for terrorism that's supposed to protect you? What about the roads that you drive on every day? What about the fire department and the police department and the schools that you send your children to? Oh, well, then it's a different story. They don't want to hear about cuts then, you know. It's always about, you know, what affects them at the moment, but they don't want to look at the bigger picture and they also benefit from those services in the society.
Austin, we'll send our kids to private school.
Yeah.
We don't need public schools. Let's close them down. Let's bankrupt them. And so everybody's going to have to go to for-profit private schools. I mean, you know, it's heading that way, too.
And for-profit schools, they never show a decent achievement in private schools. I mean, in for-profit schools. Because, you know, it's all about let's cut the, you know, money for equipment. Let's cut this. Let's cut that. Cut on textbooks. And that's where we're heading. And, you know, we're rapidly heading to a state where we're not going to recover anymore. If you look at math scores, science scores, countries like Estonia are ahead of the United States at this point.
Right.
It's a tragedy.
Now, anybody that thinks that a for-profit school is going to turn the educational system around in this country is a fool. I mean, it's plain and simple.
Well, and not just that, it's patently discriminatory. I had a friend who taught in just outside of Queens a few years ago, and he at a community college, and he taught science. And the teachers would literally say, you know, oh, we're going to do everything for these M's. But that's the point, you know, they're all criminals. This is in 2000, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What about the kids in the inner cities who can't go to private schools? It's this manifest injustice which is going to lead us to a lot of problems in this country.
Well, and the other thing you hear so often is, and I think people aren't well versed on what's going on, but everybody that really is knows that, for example, that the amount of money of the GDP that's spent on welfare now is considerably less than it was back in the 60s and 70s. And so, I mean, it's gradually been, the welfare money's been cut down to such a small percentage. But people will gripe and bitch about that, about this single mother you're talking about, maybe having to send a kid to daycare or get some help that way, but they can give the huge tax cuts to ExxonMobil. They can give the corporate welfare out all they want to, and that's okay. Pass out that corporate welfare.
Yeah, we could build the largest embassy on earth in Iraq, or you know, we have, I think, $8 billion are just missing, you know, and that's fine. You know, find me two black women who allegedly cheated on welfare, and you'll have all the wonderful libertarians come out, oh, how could we do this, blah, blah, blah. But when it comes to Iraq, and when it comes to, you know, just whatever kind of spending or a bridge to nowhere that costs $1 billion, oh, that's fine. We're not going to question that, you know.
Sure.
Why don't we quadruple the amount of welfare given up? It'll still be, you know, a hell of a lot less than what these projects.
Yeah, that's right. That is exactly right. As always, you state it well. You do.
So that was my idea.
Thank you for calling. I do appreciate it very much.
Thanks.
Well, yeah, and you know, I wish people would know the entire truth. And wonderful. I mean, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. That's a wonderful thing. It is, and we applaud that by anybody that does it. But I always like to let everybody know that not everybody's exactly the same. It doesn't work exactly the way for, you know, that way for everybody. So, anyway, let's move on. Just get that. We're in the next hour. I mentioned we're going to talk about Mr. Cheney. Anybody want to talk about Mr. Cheney? An interesting subject indeed. I've done a lot of research over the past months on Richard Cheney, and I will say this. I think he's one of the more fascinating guys to ever set foot on the planet. I do. I think Dick Cheney is an amazing study in humankind. And I know the word kind and Cheney don't belong in the same sentence, but he is. He's a very, very, very interesting man, and we're going to talk a lot about him in the next hour, and I hope he doesn't mind. Maybe he'll call in. If anybody knows the office number there at the old executive office building at the vice president's office, why, get him to give us a call. I would love to talk to Mr. Cheney. Of course, he's probably in a secret, undisclosed location where he usually spends money. Why is that? Do any of you know that? So many times you hear that to Mr. Cheney. You know, you don't see him for weeks and weeks and weeks at a time. So, well, he was at a secret undisclosed location. I don't know. I mean, do they come out of the bunker and go hunting and shoot somebody and then go back to the bunker again? I mean, it's just. And I have news for him. You know, he has been out on a speaking tour a few times in the past couple of months. Not good. Not good. Really not good to take a guy with an 18% approval rating and trot him out to give speeches to anybody, even probably the NRA. I doubt that his approval rating is too much higher than the 18% at the NRA. And, you know, they love guys like Dick Cheney, but they don't love him very much. And we're going to talk quite a little bit about him in the next hour. We'll try and fill up at least a half hour with Dick Cheney talk anyway. And interesting. Hey, did you see the story about the Arctic Ocean might hold massive oil reserves? That's, you know, keep on saving oil as much as you can and all that. That doesn't mean we should go out and blow it all here, but they say it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of money to get the oil out of the Arctic Ocean. Hey, let's take a quick call here before we get to the top of the hour. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah. Are you?
Yes.
Guy Young?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Dave. Now, it worked differently today. It rang a long time, and it never did have your machine answer.
Oh.
But that last caller, I was inspired by him. And I think that the laziest of people are those who are living on country clubs with auto deposit of their inheritances and such. They tend not to be terribly productive. I don't think that's who your emailer was referring to.
No.
Your colleague, Tom, who's not given to exaggerations or overstatements, feels that today is the biggest news day in the history of the United States, and there's been a lot of big things that have happened, but never before has it been conclusively demonstrated that the occupants of the White House for the second time have never been elected to either office at any time. The evidence is overwhelming that they lost and lost big. All trickery, all gimmick. So,
well, the sad fact is, Dave, and why I've never gotten too involved in that situation, as you know, I believe it. Sad fact is, what are you going to do about it?
Well, you know, I think in almost any other country right now that they would be saying out of the...
Absolutely. House. That's what ought to be done. But
the problem we've got is such weak or corrupt senators and congressmen that they both look the other way and hope that it'll go away. Folks still there with their same trick voting machines. It's just unthinkable. But the press does not want to look at this. RFK, who's a significant individual, is telling the world in his publication today both elections were stolen, proving it, really, demonstrating it with clear evidence.
Well, I've read the article, and it's a good one. It's right there. I mean, it really is, and I hope. But the fact remains, it's like you said, if we were in any other country, or most any other country, not all of them, the people storm the White House, drag their asses out, and say, "Hey, you cheated to get here. You're out." But we're more civil than that here, and we just so if you can lie, cheat, and steal, you can go ahead and keep your office and try it again the next time. I mean, that's just I'm afraid that's just how it is.
Too many of the people that would. You know, well, I guess certainly the aggressive belligerents are all on the other side.
Yeah.
Democrats tend to be much more polite, but we have criminals that have stolen a White House. They're there illegally, and it should not be tolerated.
I heartily agree. I do. Dave, got to go.
Thank you, Guy.
Yeah, thank you. Got the news coming up in just a couple of minutes. Don't go anywhere. Keep it here. We're going to talk about Dick Cheney the next hour.
Allegations that a handful of U.S. soldiers may have killed Iraqi civilians. Iraq's prime minister today lashed out at the American military in harsh terms, He denounced what he characterized as, quote, habitual attacks by U.S. troops against Iraqi civilians. The head of the Iraqi Human Rights Association says, quote, it looks like the killing of Iraqi civilians is becoming a daily phenomenon. The Iraqi Prime Minister also says that he will fill the vital Defense and Interior Ministry post by Sunday. Those announcements are expected to help stop the rampant violence across Iraq. Today, bombs at several Baghdad locations, including a pet market, killed 7 and wounded more than 60. A U.S. Army dog handler was demoted and sentenced to 90 days of hard labor today for using his dog to assault a prisoner at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. This is the 11th conviction in the case. At a speech in Southern California yesterday, Senator John Kerry said he plans to introduce an amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill that would call for a total withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq by the end of the year. Kerry admits that the idea will be unpopular with some members of the Senate. President Bush will reportedly announce on Monday that he will promote a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. The Senate is scheduled to vote Tuesday on that amendment. The Iranian president defiantly vowed that the West will not deprive his country of nuclear technology. Yesterday in Vienna, the world powers came to an agreement on incentives to offer Iran to halt its uranium enrichment activities. Political leaders in Washington and New York are upset with a cutback in funding from Homeland Security in favor of smaller cities such as Omaha, Nebraska, and Charlotte, North Carolina. The Homeland Security Department responds that part of the reason why New York will receive less money is because the city has no national monuments or icons to protect. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says he has reluctantly reached an agreement with the federal government to deploy 1,000 members of the California National Guard along the U.S.-Mexico border. The sticking point, the cost, will now be covered by Washington. The governor says the guardsmen will only be sent to the border if they volunteer. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hey, I told you I was having one of those days. People running the news decide to take a hike right in the middle of it. What's up with that? I don't know. Maybe they're having storms and so forth, kind of like we have a little bit here today. It's the rainy season in Southwest Florida. Yes, indeed it is, and we're so happy about that. And glad to have some rain and get all this dryness out. But I had a Florida story around here I wanted to tell everybody about. Where is it? What did I do with my Florida story? Oh, here we go. We've got this really great Democrat running for government, or for governor here. We've got two, actually. We've got Rod Smith, who is a fabulous candidate for governor. You couldn't ask for a better candidate. I don't care where you go. You couldn't ask for a better candidate than Rod Smith for governor of the state of Florida. And then there's the other guy, the bum, Jim Davis. I hope, like everything, Rod Smith wins this primary. I'm just up front and, hey, some of the Democrats who were for Jim Davis aren't going to like to hear me say that, but sorry, pal, you helped author the bankruptcy bill. I don't go for that. And also, Jeb Bush tore him a new one yesterday. And he's right. God, it hurts to sit here and say Jeb Bush was right. Do you understand how bad that feels to me? that Jeb Bush was absolutely right what he said about Jim Davis? He's in the bottom 10 for attendance in Congress? The bottom 10? Oh, man, what does that tell you? You know, if he gets... If he wins the primary, he will have done some serious wool pulling over people's eyes. That's a fact. Anyway, Rod Smith sent this note out, and I wanted to let everybody know here in Florida, let a lot of you know what's actually happening here. And I think this will interest the entire country. Got this yesterday from Rod. It says, you know, today's the start of hurricane season in Florida, with so many homeowners across the state still recovering from last year's storm damage. Our Republican leaders should have helped our citizens prepare for the season ahead, right? Well, they didn't. As people across the country get ready for what experts say could be the worst storm season in history, Republican leaders have instead sided with their friends in the insurance industry. By refusing to consider common sense efforts to provide relief from skyrocketing insurance premiums, Republican senators have turned their backs on hurricane victims and shown complete disregard for the risk we face. Stand up and make your voice heard today. Tell Republican leaders to choose Florida's families over corporate cronies. Let me just give you an example, the rest of you around the country. We are heavily, heavily tilted here in the Senate in Florida toward the Republican Party. Republican Senate leaders waited until the final hours of the final day of the legislative session to force a vote on Senate Bill 1980. While the bill includes $715 million to pay down the debt in citizens' property insurance, that money does not even cover half of the estimated $1.7 billion shortfall facing the state's insurer of last resort. It's kind of a high-risk insurance. If you can't get it anywhere else, you get the citizens. And I'm afraid yours truly is looking at this. Our state's been hit by 8 storms in just the past 15 months. As I travel the state, I'm constantly amazed by the number of families living under blue roofs. To those of you around the country, they put these blue tarps on the roof, and you can still see thousands of them in Florida. Here's just a few examples of the rising cost of insurance premiums Floridians face. State Farm, Florida's largest insurer, has requested premium rate increases by an average of 70% nationwide. Statewide. South Florida may witness even more drastic increases, with Miami-Dade residents potentially experiencing a 142% increase, 130% in Broward, and 127% for Palm Beach. And I can tell you that in Southwest Florida, we're talking about increases in that neighborhood as well. Allstate, currently serving 650,000 policyholders, recently announced it's dropping 174,000 customers. So things are tough here in Florida with insurance, folks. And I understand. I know. I've heard the cry, well, why don't you get out of there? Well, I guess it's a price we're going to pay for living where we do. But I would also remind you, those that talk about these high insurance rates is though it's justified, it is not in most cases. It is not. These are companies who have paid many dividends out over the years and not had to pay many claims. They were highly profitable last year, almost all of them. And here they are dumping people because they see a storm is coming, or a, you know, one of those years coming. 866-546-5254. I want to take some time and talk about one of my favorite guys. And I think since I've spoken to a lot of you, he's one of your favorite guys too. And I'm going to talk about the most powerful man on earth. And you say, oh, you're going to talk about George Bush. No. I'm going to talk about the most powerful man on earth. This man, Cheney. He is the most powerful man on earth. Bush is a dope. He's the puppet. Cheney is running the show. He has run the show since he started, and he will, you know, since the Bush administration started, and he will until he leaves the vice presidency. This man, Cheney, you know, when you stop and think about it, what did this country ever do to deserve a man like him running the country? Stop and think about it. Day after day, we read a news story about some new secrecy deal going on in Cheney's office to consolidate more power in the White House, power that he doesn't mind using himself and has over and over again. In fact, even before raising his hand to take the oath of office, and I know many of you remember this, the man told the press, and he was right up front. He told them, he said, this White House is going to take back all of the power the executive branch has given away over the years. And when I read that, I thought he was probably just blowing smoke. Hardly. Guy doesn't blow smoke. I never liked the guy from day one. But then it seems that almost no one does. He's an odd sort of character, and the press has not been kind to him. But it would be hard to be kind to a guy like Dick Cheney. I personally know two men, two really good men, who served with him in Congress. And as it would happen, both of them are Republicans. They're no longer in Congress. And both of them have said that Cheney is possibly the most despicable character that they've ever met. Dick Cheney, the Vice President of the United States. I've studied a great deal about him over the years, and frankly, when he announced that he's going to be Bush's Vice President, I knew we're in for a real rough ride. This is a man who is driven. He's obsessed with power and secrecy. He's belligerent. He's rude. He's ruthless. And to his everlasting benefit, completely savvy to the ways and the workings of political life. So the question becomes, was this guy created for this current political situation, or was the current political situation created by him? You go around Washington, and I'll guarantee you, it is not hard to solicit opinions and facts about Dick Cheney. Not hard at all. You can get anybody to talk about Dick Cheney, maybe except his staff. I've talked to many people who know him, and I can tell you that I have never spoken to a single person who said a kind word about Cheney's personality. Not a single one. No one seems to like the man, although he commands the utmost respect by those under him, and those under him includes every bureaucrat in Washington, D.C., and I'd hasten to add that his underlings include the entire Congress of the United States, the presidential cabinet, and in the present situation, even the president himself. Those people are all Dick Cheney's underlings. The present situation is one that Cheney has carefully and oh, so skillfully cultivated over the years. He's never missed an opportunity to move himself up the ladder in Washington and even in the private sector. He was the classic opportunist. Never one to be shy about promoting himself. Although he almost always did it really quietly, behind the scenes, in undisclosed locations. Cheney is clever. And he has cleverly positioned himself over the years to be in the exact position he's in right now. This is the perfect situation for Dick Cheney. He holds all the cards, but not the responsibility. And what better position could a politician drunk with power possibly want? He's running the show. He's behind the scenes. Bush is taking the hits. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful situation for Cheney. You know, you might think that such a powerful guy would have a distinguished background. At least maybe distinguished by educational means or by giving himself to a cause or being dedicated to his colleagues. In Cheney's case, it's quite the contrary. First of all, Cheney dropped out of Yale. I read some writings by his own roommate, Dick Cheney's roommate at Yale, Jacob Plotkin, said, and I quote, "It's hard to flunk out of Yale. It's something that one really has to put effort into. Yale at that time tried to make sure everybody who entered graduated. Where others might spend some time on the weekend studying, Dick was either talking, drinking, or playing cards with his football buddies." And when they say that Yale tried to make sure everybody who graduated, stop and think who a lot of the people were at Yale, and you will understand why they tried to make sure everybody graduated. Keep those dollars flowing in from those rich families, folks. So when Cheney dropped out of Yale, And my apologies to any of you who graduated from Yale and did it the right way. But when Cheney dropped out of Yale, he went back to Wyoming and he took a job with a local power company. And, of course, Vietnam was getting to be quite a deal then, and he was classified 1A for military service in 1962. I looked all this up. That same year, he was arrested for drunk driving. What is it about this White House and their drunk driving arrest records, really? Anyway, in 63, Cheney applied for his first student draft deferment in March. He was not a student at the time, okay? I want to stress that. He applied for a student draft deferment in March, and he was not a student at the time. That seems odd to me that a non-student would get a draft deferment as a student draft deferment. Anyway, in July of the same year, he applied for his second draft deferment after enrolling in the University of Wyoming. Then in October of 64, Cheney applied for his third student draft deferment and married Lynn, who he's now been married to for, what is it, about 42 years near as I can figure. And in November of 65, Cheney got his fourth draft deferment. By then he was getting to be an expert on deferments. But then he graduated from Wyoming, and once again he's listed as 1A. That's November of 65. And he's married by then. So in January of 66, when his wife was about 10 weeks pregnant, man, this worked out good. Cheney applied for a 3A status, which was the hardship exemption, which includes men with children or dependents, dependent parents. By now, he knows enough about the deferment process. He knows it inside and out. He could have started a draft consulting firm had he chosen to do so. And he'd probably been successful with it. But in January of 67... Cheney turned 26, and when those days when you turned 26, you were no longer eligible for the draft. And in 68, and I could not find out anywhere I looked how this happened. In 68, he won a congressional scholarship with Wyoming Republican Congressman William Steiger, and he goes to Washington. And in my humble opinion, that was the beginning of the end for the United States. I probably wouldn't have to tell some of you this, but do you know what job Dick Cheney had for the Republicans? Do you know? Play Jeopardy here. He went to college campuses around the country and spied on students who demonstrated against the war and then reported back to Washington. That's how Dick Cheney's official paid political career got started. Spied on students who demonstrated against the war. In 1969, he went to work for Donald Rumsfeld. I guess his spying paid off. He was Rummy's special assistant at the office, and I love this, the Office of Economic Opportunity. Economic Opportunity. He must have learned a hell of a lot while he worked there because he's been one of the great economic opportunists that I've ever heard of. Anyway, having been a good Republican soldier, Cheney joined Gerald Ford's presidential transition team when Nixon resigned in 1974. And get this, in 1975, he became assistant to President Ford and chief of staff. Think about that. In 6 years in political life, he becomes chief of staff at the White House. Imagine that. 6 measly years, and he'd wormed his way into running the White House. I think that's pretty damn impressive. Wouldn't you? I think it is. Very, very impressive. This was no ordinary guy. This was somebody who knew how to scratch and claw and climb over anybody he had to get ahead, and he wasn't shy about doing it from all that I've heard. And talk about taking the bull by the horns and running every last detail of the joint. Here's a couple of little things that I'd like for you to remember when you hear Cheney talking about his days at Halliburton. Didn't know this and do that and didn't know that. A reporter who covered him for a lot of years found memos from Cheney about what salt shakers would be used at the White House dinners when he was chief of staff. Or whether Betty Ford should have a headrest on the helicopter or not. Or who got White House Christmas cards and who didn't. It's all becoming clearer, isn't it? So, at the age of 37, he has his first of several heart attacks. I guess the pressure of walking all over people was getting to be too much for him. But in the same year, he ran for and was elected a congressman from Wyoming. I guess the people in Wyoming in those days didn't have a hell of a lot of sense. But they sent Dick Cheney to Congress. But in the same year, actually, what year was this? I'm trying to think what year was. Okay. I want to be sure to have my facts straight. This was a downgrade for him when he ran for Congress. A big downgrade for him. You know, he was chief of staff at the White House. Those people have got nothing but contempt for lowly congressmen. You take a look at that situation. Right? You'll see what I'm talking about. You take Karl Rove and a congressman. Guess who's going to win that battle every time? So this was a step down, but he didn't have any choice because Jimmy Carter's in the White House. Well, not being satisfied to be this lowly congressman from a politically meaningless state, and I mean meaningless in the political sense, Cheney becomes chairman of the Republican Policy Committee from 1981 to 1987. And in the interim, always remember this. He actually voted against a House resolution calling for the release of Nelson Mandela and the recognition of the ANC. What does that tell you about this guy? Voted against a House resolution. Folks, this isn't some American law here. This is just a resolution that the Congress of the United States was going to send to South Africa and say, hey, we wish you'd let Nelson Mandela out of prison. And Dick Cheney voted against it. In 1988, he became the House Minority Whip, and he has quadruple bypass surgery to clean out his pipes by then. And in 1989, he was appointed Secretary of Defense when George Bush's first choice, John Tower, was rejected by the Senate for personal misconduct. And there are people in Washington that will tell you today that it was Cheney himself who was fanning the flames against John Tower because he wanted that job. Wouldn't be much of a stretch, would it? And by the way, it was during his Senate hearings that he was asked why he hadn't been in Vietnam, and he said, quote, I had other priorities in the 60s other than military service, end quote. So in 1990, he finally gets to indulge in his fetish for sending other people off to war. Norman Schwarzkopf briefed him about the Iraqi threats in Kuwait. Cheney flies over to Saudi Arabia and convinces King Fahd to allow U.S. troops into his country. That's what started all this mess with bin Laden. And in September, the Pentagon says that 250,000 Iraqi troops, keep this in mind, in September of that year, the Pentagon, Department of Defense, Dick Cheney, says that 250,000 Iraqi troops with 1,500 tanks are massed on the Saudi border. I always thought it was odd, but we never saw photos of that claim. No ground photos, which would have been easy enough to get, nor did we see any aerial recon photos either, which would have surely existed if he was competent at all as being Secretary of Defense. However, here's the rub in this whole thing. A little-known fact is that the Russians did have satellite photos, which did not show Iraqi troops amassed on the Saudi border. These photos were presented by reporter Jean Heller to Cheney's office. She said she was going to run the story, and they simply ignored her. She said if they could prove her story was untrue, she wouldn't print it, but they totally ignored her. These photos have never been shown. I wonder why. I wonder why. So then Dickie gets his heart's desire, and he's involved in a war. After all, what self-respecting Secretary of Defense wouldn't want a war to make his mark on the military and in the history books, right? And just as a little side note, during Desert Storm, Cheney hires Halliburton to put out 320 wellhead fires and engage Halliburton's subsidiary, Brown & Root, to rebuild courthouses, schools, utilities, police stations, and computer systems in Kuwait. June the 10th of that year must have been a wonderful day for Cheney because he got to be honored in a ticker tape parade in New York City right down Broadway for winning the war almost by himself, to hear him tell it. He did so well, in fact, that Bush 1 gave him the Medal of Freedom for his work in the Gulf War. So in 1992, Cheney pays Halliburton, Brown, and Root $8.9 million. Remember, he's still the Secretary of Defense. He pays Halliburton, Brown, and Root $8.9 million for two studies on how to downsize the military. Know what their recommendation was? You guessed it. They recommended that they, Halliburton, Brown, and Root, do all of the support for the military for 5 years, and the Army Corps of Engineers hired him to do the job. What a remarkable coincidence. Remarkable. This is the beginning of a truly amazing series of coincidences involving Cheney and Halliburton. So in 1992, Halliburton is hired to provide assistance to U.S. troops in Somalia. Then in 93, Cheney sets up a political action committee and thinks about running for president. And in another very odd coincidence, the CEO of Halliburton contributes a buttload of money to Cheney's PAC. And don't you know, after deciding that the American people might not be keen on electing a likable guy like him as president, Cheney goes fishing with Halliburton's CEO, Thomas Cruickshank, and other captains of industry up in New Brunswick. And what do you know? They asked Cheney to be their new CEO. Okay. And let's not chastise only Cheney for his dealings with Halliburton and friends. Lyndon Johnson was pretty damn chummy with him as well. Halliburton's got a way of getting to politicians, and I think we all know what way they get to the politicians, don't we? Well, while Cheney was CEO of Halliburton, there were some very unfortunate happenings that he just didn't know about. And this is what I want to go back to. This is the guy who micromanaged the White House and decided which salt shakers was, you know, they were going to use. He was CEO of a company that was illegally doing business with Iraq, and he says he didn't know about it. Didn't know. He's deciding about headrest for Mrs. Ford and salt shakers in the White House for dinner. But he didn't know that his company that he was the CEO of was doing business with Iraq, which was illegal. Now, there's only two possibilities here. Very simple, only two. Either he didn't know about it and was a very poor CEO and therefore shouldn't be the Vice President of the United States, or he did know about it and is a bold-faced liar, and in that case, too, he shouldn't be the Vice President of the United States. You decide which one it was, but all in all, Cheney seems to get the job done for Halliburton because during the time he's there, they got a $2.3 billion federal contract, which was almost double the total they got over the previous 5 years. And, oh, yeah, I almost forgot a little-known fact. They also got $1.5 billion in taxpayer-insured loans, too. Just a little-known detail that I found interesting. Oh, and Halliburton was fined almost $4 million for selling products to Libya. Libya. Muammar Gaddafi. He's our pal now, you know. But Halliburton, while Cheney was CEO, was fined $4 million for selling products to Libya that could be used to trigger a nuclear device. But Cheney can't be accused of not taking care of his pals. No, sir. While he was the CEO of Halliburton, he made a video for their auditing company, Arthur Anderson. You know, this story gets to be funny after a while. It's so ridiculous that were you writing a book of fiction, some would say, no, I'll take it back. It's not true. No, of course it isn't true. It's fiction, but it's not believable. So he makes this video for their auditing company, the company that audits Halliburton, Arthur Anderson. In it, he says, and I quote, "I get good advice, if you will, from their people based upon how we're doing business and how we're operating over and above just sort of a normal by-the-books auditing arrangement. They've got the traditional role to fill as our auditors. They do that extraordinarily well." Just 5 years later, Arthur Anderson collapsed in the fallout of the Enron scandal. Just think of the fingerprints this guy's got on things. In 1996, Cheney thinks the public might have forgotten about what a money-grubbing asshole he is, and he thinks about running for president again. And he only raised $1 million, and of course he wasn't going to spend any of his money, so he gives up the idea of running for president. I can't believe he did it the second time, really. And in another nasty little matter, it seems that Halliburton was illegally selling parts to Iran for oil rigs. This was prohibited by U.S. law, and Halliburton got caught. And a guy named, what was his name, Abdul Mahdi, he took the rap for it and spent 4 years in U.S. custody for evading export laws. He wrote a letter to Cheney which said, "If I'm guilty, you're guilty. If you're innocent, I'm innocent. You did business with the same country that I did. I guess Dick didn't write him back, evidently." And then there's the little matter of the fabulous CEO of Halliburton okaying the purchase of Dresser Industries for $7.7 billion. Right after the purchase, there were numerous asbestos-related lawsuits filed against them, and it forced several Halliburton divisions into bankruptcy. Halliburton's stock fell 80% in 1 year. And in 2000, Halliburton opened an office in Tehran while Cheney is still CEO. They got out of Iraq at the same time. These guys sure know when and where to operate, don't they? So in the spring of 2000, Junior Bush asked Cheney to help him find a vice presidential running mate. Uh-huh. And in June of that year, Cheney tells the World Petroleum Congress, listen to this, I looked this up, a speech he gave to the World Petroleum Congress in Calgary, Canada. "We're kept out of there," he's talking about Iran, "We're kept out of there primarily by our own government, which has made a decision that U.S. firms should not be allowed to invest significantly in Iran, and I think that's a mistake." This is Dick Cheney, CEO of Halliburton, as a private citizen, telling the World Petroleum Congress in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, that the U.S. is wrong and not allowing investments in Iran, and this same man right now is clamoring to nuke Iran. And then, when questioned about it, in July, Cheney says he never voted against releasing Mandela from jail. He actually said he denied that he ever voted that way. He says he was only voting against imposing sanctions. And I looked it up. There were no sanctions in that bill. None. Zero. Nada. But he said that's why he voted against the Mandela bill, because there were sanctions in it, and there were not. If you don't believe me, look it up. What a liar the guy is. So in August, Cheney quits Halliburton, but they hand him a little token of their appreciation as he walks out the door, and they give him stock worth around $30 million. And it just so happens that after giving Cheney the $30 mil, they lay off a bunch of people. They sell off some assets because of weakness in its construction and its engineering business. And the day after the layoffs were announced, they announced that they're under a grand jury investigation for overbilling the government of California. Of course, this is just another one of those Cheney coincidences. A few days later, he had his fourth heart attack. Cheney was accused of insider trading when he sold his stock in Halliburton right before their stock collapsed, but nothing was ever done about it. When a guy's about to become the leader of the free world, you wouldn't want to mess around with something like investigating for stock fraud, would you? Hell no. And during the election campaign, Cheney has the unmitigated gall to tell ABC News, "I had a firm policy that we wouldn't do anything in Iraq, even arrangements that were supposedly legal. However, if you look at the facts, during his time as CEO, Halliburton was selling millions of dollars to Iraq in supplies for its oil industry. The deals were done through the old subsidiaries of Dresser Industries." So during Dick Cheney's tenure at Halliburton, think about this. While he was this man that's the axis of evil and all this sort of thing, and been pushing the best hawk on war that this administration could ever want, while he was CEO at Halliburton, that Halliburton did business, and plenty of it, with Libya, Iran, and Iraq. Good guys, these Halliburton folks. They really are. And of course, their beloved former CEO, a heck of a guy too. We'll talk some more about that when we come back. Don't go away.
I shall not see, and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Are you having burritos for lunch?
On the last Fourth Estate, we heard from Robert Fisk.
What has now become a habit of compromising on the semantics of reporting in order to avoid criticism. You know, if you call a Jewish settlement or neighborhood a colony, you'll be criticized and called potentially anti-Semitic.
And a little bit of activist history and the Red Scare.
On the line with us right now, we have Kate Fossil, biographer of Anne Braden.
You know, I got interested in Anne's life because of her being a white Southern voice against racism. And
leave it to our listeners to ring up and keep it light.
I don't either. And, you know, Bruce is concerned about the remote control for his DVD player. I mean, I'm thinking about getting rid of the remote control on my blow-up doll. I mean, you know.
What's his name?
I never kiss a tell.
FourthEstateRadio.com.
Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I wanna be just like my president. I wanna make more money than I can spend. I wanna build more bombs than I can send. Somewhere I can even spell the name of. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I want a big, big Mac and double fries. I want to wave my American standards high. I want to fly my flag across your sky. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. Come on, you black and Hispanic boys. We'll keep you poor so you've got no choice but to join the army in your prime. We'll fight for Uncle Sam and die. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century.
And welcome back. Glad to have you back with us here at the Guy James Show today. Kind of a laid back Friday afternoon. I guess Fridays always are. I'm someday going to get over the fact that I expect Friday to be like every other day of the week, but it just is not, and I need to accept that it is not. There is this word of conservatives. It's conservatives who are driving Bush's approval down, and that's what I hope a lot of those people will get through their heads. Democrats' opinion of Bush hadn't dropped at all. Not a bit, really. I'm not kidding. Maybe 1%. You won't find anybody on our side of the aisle that thought anything of this guy whatsoever. They all thought he was a stooge to start out with. I mean, everybody did. And that was giving him a fair break. But they knew he was Cheney's stooge. I mean, everybody knew that. If you'd studied just what I just told you about Dick Cheney there, you would have known this guy was Dick Cheney's sock puppet. So we gave him the benefit of the doubt, but it was apparent right away, and I mean right away, that Dick Cheney was running the show, and he has continued to run the show all through this administration, this sorry administration. And what makes you think that the man who is running the country, the most powerful man in the world, Dick Cheney, is running this country? What the hell would make voters think that this man would have any more ethics, morals, and scruples than he did when he was running Halliburton? Was he going to have some sort of an epiphany overnight and all of a sudden become moral and righteous and do things the right way for a change? Was he going to stop his lying, evil ways? Not hardly. He lived his whole life that way. He was a drunken bum. An ambitious one, nonetheless. I'm amazed at the American public. I really am. The 29. We always talk about the 29, and I'm going to have a plaque made or a sign made or something to pay homage to the 29. I might get a bumper sticker saying congratulations 29 and put it on my car or something, because of the people, by the people, for the people, majority rules and all that, and 29% of the people, you're the folks that put him in. The 29, you're the ones that really hung in there for him. Just imagine if, I don't want to go there. I don't want to start that argument today. It's not an argument, and I do encourage everybody to go to rollingstones.com. Rollingstones.com. I mean, there's not a more credible website, not a more credible publication than Rolling Stone. And read the article on there by RFK Jr. He's backed it all up. It's not bullshit. It's facts, folks. It's facts. It's page after page, and it's 12 pages. If you print it out, it's 12 pages of unarguable facts that Republicans prevented more than 350,000 voters in Ohio from casting ballots or having their votes counted. That's enough to have put John Kerry in the White House. I mean, we've known it all along. And Brad Friedman has done a wonderful job of getting it out in front of the public. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr. brings out this article, and with his name and all, adds a lot of credence to the story. Puts a kind of a backbone in it, if you will. But it's there for everybody to read. Was the 2004 election stolen? Oh, does a bear never mind? I won't go there. Yes, it was stolen. So, it wasn't Democrats that put these people in office. It was these people that just won't give up on him. And what I'm wondering is, a good friend of mine, we constantly talk about this, that there are many, many, many people, and this is what the Democrats are going to have to be so careful of. It's like going through a minefield. It really is. Here's the thing I'm terribly afraid of in these midterm elections this year, is that the Democrats will become overconfident, and they will begin to believe that all the people that have jumped off of Bush's ship will jump onto Democrat ship. That's not how it works. All the people that have jumped off Bush's ship are waiting on the dock for another Republican ship to come along. They're not going to get on the Democrat ship. No way, no how, it's not going to happen. No. So that hardcore bunch that voted for Bush, you're not going to change their minds. You're just not going to. The war's going to be won, naturally, with the undecideds. The undecided. That's who's going to do it. And we've got to go after them, and go after them hard, and... You know what? The only thing we need to do, we need to make sure we get our voice out and talk to them. Just give them the truth. That's all. Don't need anything but a dose of the truth. And that's what Yours Truly Here specializes in. And we give them the truth every day. I know they don't like it. Some of them really don't like it. But that's all. What was the old saying by Harry Truman? I'm trying to think how it goes. No, was it Harry Truman? Or is it Adlai Stevenson? I'm sorry. It was either Adlai Stevenson or Harry Truman. I believe maybe it was Adlai Stevenson that said, if the Republicans will promise not to tell any more lies about us, we'll promise not to tell the truth about them. And, that was quite a statement back in that day, because there were gentlemanly politics back in those days. We were talking the other day about people like Everett Dirksen, grand old guy, Tip O'Neill, those were great days in politics. Those were fabulous days. And I know, yes, there was the smoke-filled rooms and all that, but there were some real characters. And there were some men that had character. They did. And they did their wheeling, they're dealing, and they twisted arms and all that. They didn't have an army of K Street guys coming down to visit them every single day like there is now. Sam Rayburn. My God, what a legislator Sam Rayburn was. He's a legend. And even Lyndon Johnson, when he was in Congress, he was a legend in Congress. These men were powerful men, but they had ethics. And they probably stepped over the line now and then, but politics wasn't then what it is now. And it's a shame it's deteriorated to what it is now, but we can thank the Republicans for what it is now. We can thank the likes of Lee Atwater and Karl Rove. Most of all, we can thank Rush Limbaugh. If there is a villain in this whole thing of turning politics into the dirty, vile, nasty game that it's become in most people's eyes, you can lay that whole charge at the feet of Rush Limbaugh. There's no question about that. The man doesn't have a conscience. He's never showed a hint of a conscience, not in his whole, 17-year national career that I can see. No conscience whatsoever. Takes no prisoners, gives no apologies. He's a good broadcaster. He is. And he's a great, great, one of the all-time great propagandists. There is little question about it. He's one of the all-time great propagandists. In another day, he'd have been wearing one of those snappy-looking uniforms with the high-top leather boots. In another day, he most certainly would have been. They'd have snapped him right up because he's the master of propaganda. There's no one better. There's never been anybody better. And I doubt there ever will be. Got what he claims to be, and I know that's a lie, but somewhere around 20 million people a week. Got him totally brainwashed. If he would go on the air right now and tell everybody that George Bush is a completely moral and honest and ethical man and done everything right, they'd be marching to his tune tomorrow. He's kind of laid off of it a little bit. I think he's pretty doggone ashamed of this administration as well. Oh, well. Hey, we did get the job report that always comes in this time of the month, right after the end of the month. And what a great job report for the Bush administration. They're always bragging about their job. Today brought more evidence of President Bush's failed economic record. The Labor Department announced that only 75,000 jobs were created in May, about 100,000 fewer jobs than what economists were forecasting would be added last month. In addition, job gains for March and April were actually weaker than first reported by the government. Have you noticed that during this administration how this always happens? How we get these revised figures almost every month? They'll come out in February and say, man, gains in these new jobs was just fantastic. And then late in March, they come out, we revised those, but never mind. That's what they're doing. But 100,000 fewer jobs than what that was forecast. It was very, very, very slow growth. Keep in mind, folks, that 75,000 new jobs might sound like a big deal, but we need 150,000 new jobs each month just to keep up with population growth, to break even. 150,000 jobs. Wonder how many of those jobs were burger jobs. Wonder how many of those jobs were, those 75,000 were Walmart jobs. I wonder. And in this recent report, more bad news for the average American. It magnified the growing inequalities in America. We lost 10,000 manufacturing jobs in May. 10,000 manufacturing jobs in May. And, you know, most Americans in that category are dealing with ever-rising gas prices and increased health care costs. Man. And, you know, despite Bush's latest PR campaign, the economy is failing. Oh, sure. I mean, it's taking good care of the rich folks. There's no doubt about that. They always get well taken care of. They've made sure they feathered the nest very well with the tax cuts. They got at that right away when the administration got started. Right away, they made sure that they got all those tax cuts in there just in case something happened later on. They got their tax cuts, got them done, got it over with, and they're feeling real good about it. So this new job report is not good. Auto and retail sales offering all kinds of evidence of a growing economic divide in America. The luxury cars are selling fine. Luxury goods ranging from clothing to sports cars and SUVs doing just fine. The lower priced items, not so fine. What does that tell you? And the unemployment fell to 4.6, largely because more adults chose not to participate in the job market. It's clearly a haves and have not labor market right now, but the administration doesn't like to talk about it. I don't know. It's been a downer Friday. It's been seemed like we have nothing but bad news today. I tried to find some really funny stories today to talk about, and I couldn't. There's just one bad news thing after another coming out. I want to be completely fair today, and I've knocked Bush and I've knocked Cheney today, and some Democrats as well. But I always like to be completely fair on here. Have you seen, and I want to recommend this to everybody, the Baltimore Chronicle. Take a look at the Baltimore Chronicle website. And it's baltimorechronicle.com. and check out their archives and check out an article by John Hickman on May 31st, and just 3 days ago. John Hickman at thebaltimorechronicle.com. 4 out of 5 Republican members of the U.S. House of Representatives have taken Basil Fawlty's admonition to heart, don't mention the war. Fawlty was that twitchy character played by John Cheese in the 70s BBC Fawlty Towers. You remember that? Don't mention the war. Republicans and Democrats, on the first page of their websites, check this out. The war in Iraq, only 18% mention it. The Democrats, only 23%. That sucks. Immigration, on the front page of their websites, Republicans, only 23%. Democrats, only 15%. President Bush, this one startles me. Really startles me. I can understand why Republicans on the front page of their website wouldn't want to talk about George Bush, only 17% of them, but only 15% of Democrats mention him. I do not understand that. Can someone explain that to me? Why the Democrats wouldn't put a picture of George Bush on the front page of every one of their websites? I would. I don't understand that one. I really don't. And the folks out in California are trying to get something going on a yes to a national popular vote plan. Man, wouldn't I love to see that. I would love to see the end of the Electoral College. I think that ought to go to the way of the Edsel. I think it's outmoded, outdated, probably never should have done it in the first place. Maybe in the old days it wasn't a bad idea. But it's not wrong for, it's not right for today's America. So the California Assembly is trying to say yes to a national popular vote plan and trying to get other states to go along with them on it. I think that'd be a wonderful idea to get rid of the Electoral College, that end this, all this crap of going after target states and all that sort of thing. I'd love to see the candidates just go out and campaign in every state. Or do like I said, get on TV and radio and newspaper only campaign. Forget the buses and the airplanes and the luxury hotels and all that kind of thing. Just get out and meet the American people on TV and radio, and don't spend any money. That's my game. Well, it's been a tremendously laid back program today. I almost think there's something wrong with our phones. I'm going to check them out after we're done. And I do want to thank you for listening to the program today, and we'll be back on Monday. Do remind everybody we're heading for that Take Back America conference. The following Monday, we'll be doing our show from there, the 12th. So have yourselves a good one. Have a great weekend. You've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. This has been the Guy James Show.
What do you think tribal sovereignty?